The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome, bank robbers, and thanks for peeking at the Top 100 Project, where we take a nice long look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 most awesome American flicks. Spoilers are coming. You've been warned. I am Ryan Ellis with the blonde who, much like Faye Dunaway, looks great in hats. My very own wife, Bev.
We make podcasts about people who rob banks.
Well done. We're also joined by the lazy, sleepy dog, Fox, and probably some people out there hopping and hipping on a Saturday night as we record this podcast, which is about Bonnie and Clyde. So, the coming attractions trivia for Bonnie and Clyde. Warren Beatty has, to date, only acted in 22 movies. How many of those were nominated for the AFI's Top 100?
So, obviously Bonnie and Clyde, mm-hmm. And then I'm pretty sure Reds
That's
is on the list.
Two.
But I can't think of anything else.
We've mentioned both of these in the podcast before, but they're not big name titles.
All right.
I wonder if our listeners are chomping at the bit saying, I know the other two. Because there are four. I didn't tell you that part. Yeah, there
yes.
are four.
That's too revealed.
Well, one of them was his first, Splendor in the Grass.
Really?
If not his very first movie, then one of his first movies. Oh. He made two in 1961. The other one is a great title. We're going to watch this movie, even though it didn't make the list. Robert Altman directed it. Julie Christie's in it. McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Oh, yeah. I forgot he's in that. Okay.
For many people, that is Altman's best film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely watch that soon.
So only four films of his 22 that were nominated. He's making a movie about Howard Hughes that comes out. I think it's a year from now or even longer than that. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's early next year, something like that. But the guy has not worked much.
No, but he has a pretty good track record.
Well, especially when it comes to nominations at the Oscars, because he was nominated a lot of times in mm-hmm. his career. All right, well then, the Top 100 Project's 71st movie, Bonnie and Clyde, was 27th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between Dr. Strangelove, one of our favorites, and Apocalypse Now, one of my favorites. Then slipped to 42nd, somehow dropped a bit there, in 2007 between King Kong and Midnight Cowboy. Bonnie and Clyde was released by Warner Brothers on August 13th, 1967. It wasn't a hit initially and didn't get great reviews at first either. But Warren Beatty's Persistence scored a re-release later that year, which got critical raves and drew big crowds. Bev will tell you what that film is about with the skinny.
Warren Beatty is Depression-era bank robber Clyde Barrow, who meets gorgeous Texas lazabout Bonnie Parker, played by Faye Dunaway. Along the way, they pick up mechanic C.W. Moss, played by Michael J. Pollard, and after also being joined by Clyde's brother Buck, played by Gene Hackman, and Buck's wife Blanche, played by Estelle Parsons, they all go on a stealing rampage through the South and Midwest United States.
With banjo music accompanying them all the way. Or, in a nutshell, young couple betrayed by friend's father results in roadside perforation.
Perforation is one way to describe what happens to them.
Riddled
they
with
are
bullets.
Perforated.
The real... Now, here we go. This movie, based on a real story, the actual people, Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker, were shot nearly 200 times on May 23rd, 1934, in Louisiana.
There's no way that was just law enforcement doing their job. Even though, apparently, in the real story, they weren't just hanging around getting ambushed. They actually were in their car, armed to the teeth, mm-hmm. fighting back.
And never got out of the car.
Yeah, never got out of the car, and they had guns pointed at the law.
And he was known to be such a good shot that that was one reason I was reading, too. They had to be excessive because they couldn't let him get any kind of shot off, or he maybe would clip them.
Ah.
And if it's anything like in this movie, they're hidden. There's no way that he'd realistically hit them. They're behind trees and bushes and stuff. So I don't know how much it's based on absolute reality, but it's definitely a great way to end a film. And it's just so final. They get obliterated, that slow motion thing, and then Hamer and his other people come up, look at them, and cut to black, credits, movie over.
It's kind of merciless. It's merciless of them, but it's merciless of the audience. You know, you spend the whole film growing to love these characters, and then they're not just killed at the end, they're just annihilated, yeah. They're shred to ribbons by these bullets.
They're assassinated, and that was one of the references, the JFK assassination.
Oh.
There was supposed to have been a moment where Warren Beatty's head gets kind of blown off, when he has the fruit. I was reading about this on the IMDb. That was the trigger for where the guy who had the squib was supposed to pull off a piece of his head, much like JFK got his head blown right through by that bullet.
You know, everybody's criticized this film for its violence. Everybody at the time was scandalized by the violence in Bonnie and Clyde, but it's not really that much more violent than most other crime films that we've seen from this period of time. It just shows the consequences of violence, and it shows violence from a different perspective. They're killers, but they're also kind of likable. They're not
evil. They're so great looking, that doesn't hurt.
Yeah, they are probably, I think I said this after we watched it, they're probably the best looking couple we've seen in film so far. They're both absolute drop-dead knockouts. They're likable. We're on their side the whole time, even as they're committing truly heinous acts. They're killing innocent people. They're committing crimes that should be reprehensible, but it's really gray. You just don't know whose side to be on. This is all part of what makes the film so brilliant and memorable.
One of the most important scenes of the whole movie is the scene where they're shooting at the sign on that guy's old property. And maybe another reference yet again to Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
You got the old sharecroppers, including, well, after we saw In the Heat of the Night last week, which is all about the black experience in the South.
Mm-hmm.
This movie's set mostly in the South. We only see two or three or so black characters who have pretty much no role in this movie. But one does in that scene where they're shooting at the house. And here's Clyde Barrow, who is not really famous yet or infamous, but he's offering up his gun to somebody to say, hey, shoot at that bank sign there and shoot at the windows in your old house. Stick it to the man.
Heroes of the proletariat. They were...
He was Robin Hood.
They were, yeah, except that they weren't giving back to the poor. They were glamorous and they were popular and people liked them because they were sticking it to the banks. But in no way were they really helping out the downtrodden.
No, they're the key moment that really helps in the sense of likability, apart from what we've already said, would be the moment when they're in the bank and he says, is that your money on the table there or is that the bank's? Mine? Well, you keep that then.
Yeah.
And if you're not behind these people at that point, you never will be.
Even though they're killing innocent people, shooting cops in the face, bungling. They're terrible at being criminals. They're terrible bank robbers, but they live horribly. They suffer. They kind of have terrible lives. It's not like crime pays for them in any way except adrenaline.
They don't seem to be into it for the money. They don't really ever seem to make much.
No, it's true.
It's more about doing this to have something to do.
To stick it to the man. To
have some money. Mm-hmm. And freedom definitely is a part of it too. And we're coming into the Free Love era, 1967, our second movie from this year. We've got two more to go after this. All are kind of Rage Against the Machine movies one way or another. Two of them deal directly with race. And two of them are about rebelling against authority, Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate. 90% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes. There were five rotten reviews, unfortunately, but 90% of critics liked it. 88% of audiences, pretty good scores. But only a 7.9 ranking on the IMDb, one of the lowest we've seen for a movie that's pretty popular. I was surprised to see that, too.
Yeah,
you're making a face at me, and I agree with that face you're making at me. Here's some other things we'll talk about when it comes to critical raves. Roger Ebert, we've talked about him so often, here he is again. He was a new critic at that point. He was brand new to the business, and he was one of the few people who raved about Bonnie and Clyde from the start. Pauline Kael was another one. She was not new, and she was very influential. But then two other people did not like it. Well, many others, but these two in particular. Joseph Morgenstern went from hating the movie to raving about it after it was re-reviewed. And fair enough, if he's going to watch the movie and say, you know what, I was wrong. At least he's admitting it.
I really like that story because he changed his mind. He went to see it, and it must have stuck in his mind for him to go see it again. But he gave it a second shot, and he said part of it was the reaction of the audience, and part of it was just him coming around and getting over the initial shock of it. And he wrote this kind of apology review where he took back everything he said in the first one, and Warner Brothers ended up using that in all their marketing materials.
Like, look, we,
this guy hated it, and then he loved it. Don't you have to see this film that people are talking about? And I just love the story about a critic changing his mind and giving him mea culpa, right?
Yeah. I've talked about it a few times in the project where there are four or five movies at least that I didn't like that much the first time for one reason or another, and went from being not a fan to being a fan. Magnolia, Heat, The Matrix, even Taxi Driver, I think, at one point I wasn't a big fan of, and now I think it's a brilliant film.
You didn't like The Matrix the first time you
saw it? I didn't dislike it. I just wasn't as much of a fan. I think the reason why I saw it in one enormous theater, one of those long, narrow ones. So when I saw it on DVD, I remember when I saw it when I was first getting into DVDs, grabbed it, got to have this one, been a big fan of it ever since. But I've admitted it many times. I've been wrong about movies plenty of times. I'm sure I'll be wrong about movies again. But here's a guy who would admit he was wrong. And he was fired for his pen.
Yeah.
Bosley Crowther, a guy we've mentioned a few times, very famous critic from this era, was canned by the New York Times for panning the movie because he was deemed out of touch.
How many movies can you say would get a critic fired for panning? Every single movie has one critic who hates it. And critics, you would think, have to kind of have the freedom to hate something.
Yeah.
Whether they're right or wrong, you can't really say. It's an opinion. You can't be right or wrong. This guy has the opinion, and probably people who read him and trusted him trusted his opinion. I understand why the New York Times would say, enough is enough. We have to keep up with this new generation. Mm-hmm. The tide was clearly turning by 1967. And I read two separate accounts. One that they replaced Crowther with Pauline Kael, who at the time was freelancing and wrote a 9,000-word essay about Bonnie and Clyde for The New Yorker. And the other one was a different critic whose name I cannot remember.
Well, now. She was a New Yorker person as far as I knew.
Yeah.
And Crowther was with The New York Times. So I'm not sure. I can't confirm that one or not.
Maybe. I read two separate things. But at any rate, he was fired and replaced.
That's the funny thing, too. Film criticism had mattered. But now, along with the fact that films are changing, the whole business is changing. We talked about that on In the Heat of the Night. Talked about it on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and other films, too. But film criticism is changing now, too.
Yeah. As an art form, it had kind of come to its own.
Kael and Ebert and some other people were getting to be kind of rock starish from it. Kael especially. Yeah. She had acolytes, and there are many books about her, many books written by her.
She's a great writer too. I actually
And she could hate movies that everyone else liked, and she could love movies that no one else did.
And that's what I say, like Bosley Crowther getting fired for hating Bonnie and Clyde. Imagine that Pauline Kael was held to that standard. She hated films that everybody else absolutely adored. Sound of Music, she tore it to shreds. She hated it. She wasn't shy about it. She didn't care if she made enemies, and I respect that. Even when I disagree with her, it's nice to have somebody just make a point and make good arguments to back up that point.
Well, it's people like Kael and Ebert, more so Kael, I guess, because she was a bigger name than him, that would have got people out to see this movie, because Warners wanted to essentially bury it in drive-ins. Jack Warner, we talked about this on My Fair Lady, he was the actual producer of that movie. Now, of course, that was Warner Brothers' picture, as was this. But Jack Warner called Bonnie and Clyde a three-piss picture. He was infamously known for having a very small bladder and had to go to the washroom a lot. Bonnie and Clyde is not even 2 hours, so that is a very small bladder. Or maybe too much pop or whiskey or water or something. My Fair Lady is an endurance test of a movie that's nearly 3 hours long. So talk about hypocrisy. He's another one who was a bit of a victim from this. And Warner Brothers, as a studio, realized the old man is not really seeing the future here.
Yeah.
And legend has Beatty begged Warners to re-release the movie and give it another chance.
I read that he eventually threatened to sue them. Because there was a double standard being applied to Bonnie and Clyde than was being applied to other films.
What's funny, too, is that Beatty was a producer at all. Because he wasn't a star yet. He'd never produced a film before. He wasn't a power player at all. Yeah, we talked about how many Oscar nominations he would get later in his career and how much of a player he was then and still is now. Even though he hasn't made a movie in so long, people still think of him as one of the royalty of Hollywood. Being married to Annette Bening doesn't hurt. I don't know how he got the gig in the first place.
I think he was just that passionate about the project. He read the script and he loved it so much, and he was really determined to get it made.
We've often talked about people that could have been in these movies other than the people that are. Beatty and Dunaway were great choices, and we're going to talk about their particulars soon. But he originally wanted Bob Dylan for Clyde and his ex-girlfriend, Natalie Wood, for Bonnie.
Natalie Wood? Okay. Mm-hmm. I can buy it. But Bob Dylan?
Not even an actor.
Thank God that never happened.
Maybe that was a big ruse and he wanted to play the role all along and they went through the whole casting process. Well, we can't find anybody. I guess I'll have to play it then. All right, Warren. God. He also, I guess, since he's the producer, must have recruited Arthur Penn, who he'd worked with on Mickey 1 not long before this movie. And Arthur Penn was a guy who was known for The Miracle Worker before this. And then later on, he did Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman. Some other good credits. Not a director who you're going to talk about as much as others. He also did The Missouri Breaks with Nicholson and Brando, a very infamous bomb that Brando was completely dogging his way through. But Penn had this one great hit. But the original directorial choice was François Truffaut, the French guy,
yeah,
the French New Wave.
He tried to lure Truffaut and Godard from France to Hollywood, but it didn't take. Godard apparently was pretty close to taking the job, but then just kind of started making his roster of demands, and things didn't work out so well. They offered it to lots of other directors as well. George Stevens, William Wyler, thank God that never happened. Carol Rice, John Schlesinger, Brian G. Hutton, Sidney Pollack, Arthur Penn have turned him down three times before he finally got convinced to do the project.
And Penn was the one who said that he didn't want Clyde to have been gay.
Yeah.
So then it became impotent, which is still a bit of a risk and still an unusual thing to do for a movie then or now, to have this great-looking guy who's becoming a star, who was getting to be, I said he wasn't a big name, but he was getting to be there, to have him be that he can't fornicate with this gorgeous woman. Now, here's a trivia question for you. Do they ever actually have sex in the movie?
Yeah.
Once.
And what is the event that finally gets Clyde up and running? What is it that Bonnie does that finally gets them in the bedroom? Do you remember?
No.
Because it's pretty interesting detail.
Okay, what is it?
when she gets her ballad printed in the newspaper.
Right.
And he discovers that he's famous.
Here's maybe the biggest theme in this entire movie. We said it a few minutes ago, they don't really seem to be driven by money. They seem to be driven by fame.
Mm-hmm. Notoriety.
They want to be known for what they've done as much as they want to succeed and make money at it.
Yeah, they're terrible at being criminals, but they're vanguards at winning over the media and the public.
And her little poem is...
It's not that good. It was the real poem that she wrote, although the real Bonnie Parker never submitted that to the paper. It was found posthumously through her mother, who got it published, I suppose.
And making themselves out to be something great that they... really weren't. They were just, as you said, terrible bank robbers.
Yeah, yeah. They were
their getaway guy,
awful.
Parallel Parks. One of the funnier scenes in the movie.
Funnier scenes that ends in tragedy.
Yeah, because the bank manager has the opportunity to jump on the running board, and that's when he gets shot in the face.
Yeah.
That was something that hadn't been done before, and that would have been a scandalizing moment with the old rating system. You see both a shot fired and a guy getting his face hit by that bullet and blood as well, all in the same shot. Before, it would be that whole thing where you'd shoot a gun and there'd be a cut. And then, as we've talked about in this podcast before, we haven't done a lot of gangster type films, really. But that constipation death.
You always call it the constipation. They just grab their sock.
And there's absolutely no blood anyway.
Yeah, and they hurt, but it's not what we see in Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm-hmm,
and
the guy is shot in the face.
It's funny, this film is so notorious for its violence. Beatty originally really wanted to do it in black and white, which I think would have muted a lot of the blood squibs, which was new to Hollywood films. Squibs. A squib, for those who don't know, is a little explosive that goes under an actor's clothes and is filled with theatrical blood. That's like the mechanics that they use to make somebody look like they've been shot and have the blood splatter everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Warner Brothers that insisted that they shoot it in color, which certainly made it all that much more graphic.
Probably because they would have thought it'd make more money if it was a color film. Black and white then and now is thought of as the non-commercial type of device.
Yeah, then it would have been the cheap movie. Now it's the art house movie.
And it was 1960, but Psycho and The Apartment were huge hits, and they were both black and white. Psycho was also made in black and white for the same reason, because of the blood.
Mm.
Well, the movie wasn't controversial just because of the violence. It was also because of some sexuality. We talked about his impotence and the fact that he was going to be gay. Beatty was willing to play it that way, but Penn was the one who overruled it. There's going to be plenty of stories out there, but that's what I read. I'm going to go with that one. I believe Beatty would have played it that way. And here's the second movie in 2 weeks, where you've got a beautiful woman standing naked in front of a window.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's right.
And
he's
had the young girl in the beginning, and also in the beginning of this film, Faye Dunaway. We don't see anything, but she's just standing there, just as you said in the skinny, just lazing about.
She's no shrinking violets. She's ready to go. She's the one who, the first day she meets him, she wants to sleep with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that stops her because
ain't no lover boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what is he doing when she first sees him? What's he trying to do?
Steal her mother's car.
Mm-hmm. And what do we find out very soon after that she is in that little Texas town? What's her job?
She's a waitress.
Right.
There's a great scene when they're sitting at a restaurant. I think it's either later that same day or the next day. He sees that her hair is done the same way as the middle-aged waitress who's serving them, and he makes her change it because she's not a waitress.
And she does it instantly, too.
Yeah.
She is so hooked on this guy right away. But before we really find out just how much he doesn't want to have sex or isn't capable of it, there are phallic moments early on. His matches. He's got a match in his teeth, and he's making it so it stands straight up. Well, that's obviously going to signify something right there. And, of course, he has the gunplay. So kind of like, and I said this movie a few minutes ago, Taxi Driver, a guy who can't or won't express himself through sex, but does it through violence, and specifically with guns.
Mm-hmm. And she's excited when he robs the store. That's what gets her so excited that she has to have him right away.
Mm-hmm.
That adrenaline gets her going.
And she's got something to do, yeah.
Yeah.
She even tries to give him oral sex. This is the first time we've seen even attempted oral sex in this project. I don't think there's a ton of it in the rest of the movies, actually. But she tries to get him off that way. And now, come on, stop! It isn't obvious. We don't see anything blatant. But she's clearly trying to go down there.
Yeah, it's very obvious to anybody who knows what she's trying to do.
And they're at their best when it's just the two of them. Beatty and Dunaway are very sweet together.
You know, for a couple that cannot consummate their relationship, they're incredibly passionate. Their love and their chemistry is so believable. But it's like the robberies, the crimes seem to be the stand-in for sex.
Yeah, Bonnie doesn't bail when Clyde can't do it. But she must want to when the Barrow Gang includes Buck and Blanche. Because she doesn't seem to like Buck and his sort of hick ways. And Blanche, of course, is extremely annoying. Even Michael J. Pollard's character, C.W. Mouse, she doesn't seem to dislike him. And there's apparently a scene in the script, I don't think they actually shot it, where she tried to seduce him because she wants somebody, so I'll take this little peck of wood.
I'm glad they didn't include that scene. I think it's better that she's loyal to Clyde. Their relationship is just the glue that holds the film together, right?
Mm-hmm. If Penn was willing to let him be gay or even bisexual in the film, then it would have made sense for the three of them before they add Buck and Blanche to their little group.
Yeah, I think she even says at one point, I wish we could be alone. The gang has a great group of characters, though. I really like the five of them together. CW, who's just so dopey, lovable, and creates the havoc. It definitely gets the plot moving along. Buck, I like Buck. He's a good character. And Blanche is the worst. But I think she's necessary. She just adds the friction that the film needs to keep it going. It's kind of episodic, right?
This was your first time seeing the movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I actually asked you what you thought of the movie. Did you actually like it or not?
I was quite fond of it, yes.
Probably half an hour on this podcast now. You were a big fan, yeah. You loved In the Heat of the Night. You liked this one a lot, too?
Yeah, I think what I said after we finished watching it was like, hype lived up to.
That's right, you said that.
I've been remiss to have not seen this film for this long. But in a way, I'm almost glad that I didn't see it till now because I don't know if I would have gotten it when I was younger.
Maybe not.
I don't think I, like, had the film education to really...
And the rain has begun.
Yes, it's pouring rain outside. It's the noisiest night.
Listeners, tell friends to listen to this podcast. Get us more sponsors so we can pay for a soundproof room.
I know, this is crazy.
Well, let's keep going.
All right, so as I was saying, I'm glad that I kind of got to see this movie with the maturity and better level of film appreciation than I had when I was younger and I saw a lot of these classic films for the first time because I was in film school. I'll definitely watch this film again. It's one of those great movies that I feel like every time I watch it, it'll just be like peeling the layers and, and getting deeper and deeper into everything that was accomplished and intended with it.
I'm a huge fan of this movie, too. If I had to pick one film from 67, I like the best, and we talked a little bit about this last week, I think Bonnie and Clyde might be my favorite, but Cool Hand Luke is way up there as well. In Cold Blood, I do like The Graduate. Don't love it. In the Heat of the Night was very good. But this is probably my number one.
Yeah, we've talked a lot lately about the sea change that Hollywood had in the 60s. A lot of people, when they talk about that, Bonnie and Clyde is where there was no going back. That is the film that was the biggest masterpiece out of all these pictures, but it was also a huge box office success.
Mm-hmm.
So the studios just finally realized the tides turned, and it was the genius and the success of this film.
And The Graduate picked it up. The Graduate was released later that year. That was a gigantic hit, one of the biggest hits of all time.
Easy Rider then.
And that's the other
that
one.
That was the nail in the coffin.
Those
three
counterculture movies are the ones that really got that movement going.
It's funny that the 60s you associate so much with hippies and that particular brand of counterculture, but most of the movies that are associated with the 60s aren't really about hippie stuff at all, except for Easy Rider, which even that is probably questionable. Yeah,
they just have long
drugs.
Hair. They're not really
hippies. Yeah, they're not really hippies in the sense that we always imagine hippies. And a lot of the characters in these films, they're not even baby boomers. They're not even part of the generation. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde is set in the 30s.
Right, this is a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said earlier, it's set in the Depression.
Yeah.
Well, this has a lot in common. Bonnie and Clyde has a lot in common with The Grapes of Wrath because of the Depression, because of the sharecropper thing I talked about before, and people that are just trying to survive. But the difference is that they actually do something about it. Unlike Grapes of Wrath, I'm not going to criticize them for this, but they run away. And these people kind of stay and fight back in a way.
Yeah, they try to figure it out, but still work within the system. That's the difference. Grapes of Wrath is trying to follow the rules and work within that structure. Proven by that is that the rules are so stacked against them that there's nothing they can do to survive. Bonnie and Clyde go the other way, but it doesn't work out all that well for them either.
Well, this is a loose biography, as we said. It's based on the real story of these people. Three or four of these so far in the 60s we've already covered. Spartacus was a loose biography. Lawrence of Arabia was. Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid about real people. Other movies are somewhat based on real things. Sound of Music is not really a biography, but it's based on actual people. So that's been a big thing in the 60s. I guess the whole project has plenty of it.
It's a common thing in movies. Period.
But this is one of the rare examples of people who are thought of in a negative way that were given a grand movie like this.
Is that right? Before
well,
this movie,
look at the people
was,
I just
they
mentioned.
Were always villains?
What I mean is, look what I just mentioned, Spartacus and Lawrence of Arabia. Now, Butch Cassidy came later, so we won't include that for the time being. But Spartacus, T.E. Lawrence, and Maria von Trapp are heroic characters.
Well, I think it's proven over and over again, and maybe this is the way that we grew up and experienced media anyway, but bad characters, flawed characters, are just so much more interesting than the good guys.
And the studio didn't see that coming, I guess, because the studios didn't think it would succeed. The two Lucas films, American Graffiti and Star Wars, Universal and Fox didn't have much faith in those two movies, and they were monster hits. We all know how big a hit Star Wars was, but American Graffiti was a big hit, too. And this movie, catching that zeitgeist, made it the second biggest hit ever for Warner Brothers at that time, after the movie we mentioned earlier, My Fair Lady.
Something that the documentary and book Easy Rider, Raging Bulls mentions about this generation of filmmakers that I think people always forget, this was the first generation of filmmakers that was brought up, as long as they can remember, having film in their lives and having grown up really watching movies and probably the first group of people having real access to weird films, B films, foreign films, mm-hmm. stuff that would have been hard to come by for anybody before. And so that's another big generational divide between them and the studio bosses that were stuck in that old studio way.
Also, you could watch movies of the ones you're talking about on television.
Over and over again.
I mentioned The Apartment earlier. He's trying to watch Grand Hotel on television and eventually gives up. Classic movie.
Mm-hmm. I have a great story, one of my favorite stories I ever heard from my friend Andre, who we interviewed for the film. He's mm-hmm. one of the writers of Cube.
Download it.
He's a little older than us, and he said that because when he was growing up, he loved films so much, but there wasn't really VCRs. When he would go to the movie theater, he would bring a tape recorder and tape the audio of the movie that he was watching and then listen to it after if he liked the film. Yeah. He said he listened to, I can't remember if it was Jaws or Star Wars, he just would listen to over and over
again.
That's
dedication.
Well, but that's love. That's love of film. Yeah. I think that there was a generation that grew up with that and that helped create the new Hollywood.
Well, since we're talking about influence, the French New Wave was a big part of it.
We said
Godard and Truffaut were candidates to direct the film. And it was directed in the style that they might have had in the first place. Jules and Jim, a Truffaut film, was definitely an influence on it.
Breathless, Godard. Mm-hmm. I think the writers cited both those movies as their main influence for this.
This movie influenced so many others, but Natural Born Killers, Badlands, Thelma and Louise, all very clearly were influenced by this kind of story. The unhappy ending of it, the fact that the people that we've cared about, whether they're good guys or bad guys, get blown away. Obviously, the violence, we've talked about that. The first in a run of films where the leading players are gunned down. Spoiler alert, but a lot of the movies we're going to cover in the next little while. And I've said this before on one of our coming attractions trivia, where the leading players, usually men, all of them are shot down at the end of the movie.
Another theme that's pervasive in all these films in the 60s in general is nihilism. Suddenly, this very cynical, bleak view of the world is being presented in all these films.
The deck is stacked against people like this. What is she going to do? And I think Claude even says something like that to her. You're going to marry some guy, you're going to be unhappy, and you're going to have a useless life. With me, at least it's fun, it's exciting, all this kind of stuff. Not that she has to be convinced, she already knows that's true. He's a criminal. He's out on parole. Now, he shouldn't be trying to steal somebody's car, but he's probably not going to get a decent job. That's even more true now in 2014 than would have been back in the 30s when this movie set.
Well, maybe not during the Depression. I think the Depression was still worse than what people are experiencing.
Well, of course, that part of it, but I mean the mentality.
Oh, sure,
that people like this are never going to get ahead.
That the deck is stacked against you. Yeah, that it's hopeless. You're not going to be able to work within the framework.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to make a living. And I also kind of get the impression that Bonnie, the way she is, if after everything was said and done, somebody could have said to her, well, you can either spend a year on the run with the Barrow Gang, living life like this, or you can have this life that Clyde describes, where you're a waitress, where you marry a dummy, and she would probably still pick a year on the run with the Barrow Gang. She would prefer that to a boring life in Texas living with
her
mother.
She's truly alive,
yeah.
And her mother has that line where she says, you try to live 3 miles from me and you won't live long, honey. Which is a weird line to me. Does that mean that she's saying, I would rat you out? Does that mean that you'd be found out?
I think it's that she's so notorious, if she made herself that easy to find, she'd be caught and dead in no time.
And that woman was not even an actress. They found her and they cast her. She kind of gives away
that
she's not a good actress.
That explains why she has the worst performance in the movie.
It's a flat delivery, but it actually is pretty piercing in some way that her mother's basically saying to her, no, go away. You've chosen this, so you're out of my life now. They have this nice little day together and that little picturesque kind of scene, although it's interesting that C.W. Moss is a big gun, he's standing by and obviously watching for anybody coming along, so they still have a watchtower, if you will.
One more theme I briefly want to talk about, kind of about the era in general, is that this film also fits into the framework of the Vietnam War. Really explores the ambiguity between who's a hero and who's a villain, and you have these regular American heroes who are committing unforgivable acts, a reflection of what was going on overseas.
The Wild Bunch is another movie that does that, and that's another movie that has people that are just perforated by bullets, and The Godfather also has that. I don't think The Godfather really gets into Vietnam, but another guy, spoiler alert on The Godfather, who hasn't seen this movie by now, where Sonny is overshot by the bad guys.
Michael's also a veteran.
So there are some elements. But I'm just talking about the fact that the end of this movie and the end of The Wild Bunch and that scene in The Godfather, people are not just shot, but just... If they had the kind of violence that you do get away with more so now, I think you'd see these bodies really, truly massacred. Bonnie and Clyde are shot a lot. And it is a very upsetting scene, even in 2014.
Yeah, it hasn't lost its punch.
But it would be more bloody if they did it right now.
Oh, God.
There was a miniseries they made in 2013.
Yeah, that's right.
And I've not seen it. I don't know if they go the route of having people be blown to bits but more so than this movie. But they certainly could have. They maybe would get away with it more. We've been watching Hannibal. That's a network TV show. There is a lot of blood and violence in that movie.
I know.
Or that show, I should say. All right, so Beatty, the only AFI film. We talked about some of his other credits. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Shampoo, we didn't mention that one. Reds and Bugsy, and many others, of course. Dick Tracy's a favorite for a lot of people. But only 22 films in total. A lot of the movies he made, actually, he was one of the named characters. Clyde, McCabe, Bugsy, Dick Tracy.
He was a star. He's a real leading
bit
man.
Bit of a vanity thing going on there, yeah.
He should be vain. He's very good looking.
He is a gorgeous man, yeah. He didn't make another movie after this one, though, for 3 years.
Wow.
And you mentioned the director of the film in your list earlier, directors could have done this one. George Stevens directed it, The Only Game in Town.
Yeah.
He did have long gaps in his career after Reggie didn't make another movie until the infamous Ishtar. The last movie he made was Town and Country in 2001. That was a bomb, and that movie took way too long. Nobody seemed to like it. It was pilloried. So it's going to be 13 or 14 or maybe even 15 years between movies for him. But he's been around. He's been a player. He's almost always at the award shows that they have him there. He accompanies Nep anyway, but she's nominated for awards.
Yeah, she's still very active, and she gets nominated for just about all the time.
And they've had a great marriage ever since he met her on Bugsy. His co-star, Faye Dunaway, she's in 3 epic movies and not many others I like all that much. But those 3 are fantastic. This one, her next one's going to be Chinatown, and her last one is Network. All AFI films, all nominated for Best Picture. All won a slew of awards and all kinds of accolades, and she's great in all 3 of them. I guess the other one that people might know her from is Mommy Dearest, where she plays John Crawford.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No wire hangers. I hated that movie, but I do have to acknowledge that people know it, and some of them do love it.
I wonder if it was intentional on Polanski's part, because it seems that Chinatown and Bonnie and Clyde have this whole thing about eyes. Blanche gets her eye shot out,
mm-hmm.
and then Clyde, when he's killed, his sunglasses, they're missing one of the... And that's a thing in Chinatown.
There's a flaw in her eye, she
talks
about.
Yeah, it's like everything on the left. There's a flaw in the eye, somebody gets shot in the eye, there's all these kind of symmetry things with eyes. I wonder if that was somehow inspired. I thought of it, especially with Clyde's glasses, it made me think of that.
Yeah, and thinking about her 3 movies I just mentioned, Chinatown, Network, and Bonnie and Clyde, somebody in the movie gets blown away at some point, if not the beginning, the end, or somewhere in the middle, or all 3.
Well, violence as a trend may have been started, or at least encouraged by Bonnie and Clyde. It has not gone away yet.
That's true. There's money in killing. And as far as looks go, I think she's up there with Julie Christie and Jane Fonda on the 1960s beauty scale. There are many other people, too. You mentioned Natalie Wood. But Faye Dunaway, wow.
And sexy, too.
Yeah.
She's just so gorgeous and great to watch in her attitude. She has so much character. I just love her. I love the 2 of them together.
And I said at the beginning of the podcast that she wears hats so well. Her beret was a big fashion craze. A lot of the clothes she wears inspired a big fashion craze.
Yeah, yeah. The beret and the maxi skirt both came to fashion after this.
That shot of her holding the machine gun with a cigar in her mouth, that was actually based on the real Bonnie Parker, who was also only about 4'10". So there's not that much comparison. And Bonnie Parker, the real one, is cute, but she's certainly not Faye Dunaway. But anyway, there's an actual shot of it, and it's pretty true to the real picture.
Yeah, I saw that comparison, too. Mm-hmm. I love the detail in the film where she's got the cigar in her mouth and she's acting all tough, and then she takes the cigar out and she's kind of disgusted by it, and it's her managing her image.
Yeah.
This is in the 30s. To think that there was people doing this in the 30s, whereas now we're just so used to it. It's part of everybody's lives and we all assume it.
And what is her job in Network but to manage somebody's image?
And that's all she thinks about in Network. She's obsessed with it. That's true. Good point.
She's great in that film. She won the Oscar for that film, but you don't really get much character development from her. She is so obsessed with television and doing the job and getting ratings, making money. She doesn't have much of an arc in that movie, and yet she's brilliant in it.
Yeah.
But you don't learn much about her.
I don't think there's much to learn about her. That's what's implied.
I guess that's the case, yeah. All right, I've talked about Gene Hackman a little bit on the podcast leading up to this. This is the first time he's been in a movie, though, and he's going to be in 2 more. He's also in The French Connection and Unforgiven, all 3 have violent themes. As much as I love him, I think he's one of the greatest actors of all time, without any doubt. He's got such a long resume. Hoosiers, I'll watch that movie any day. And there's a dozen more. Crimson Tide, so many movies I love of him. I don't know if he really has a critical role, though. He comes in, he's a little goofy. He does tell that recurring joke, and that's a nice theme, too, where first he makes Clyde laugh about the joke about don't sell the cow, and then later on he tells the same joke to Gene Wilder and Evans, nobody, who's probably heard this joke over and over again in the car, the rest of the group, at least, is laughing.
I love that detail. Just illustrating that he's kind of a dope. They're all kind of dopes. Mm-hmm.
But again, you talk about stardom. When they're robbing one of the banks, and they do it effectively, the 3 of them, Bonnie, Clyde, and Buck, were the Barrow Brothers. Interesting that he doesn't mention Bonnie in there, not the Barrow Gang. So maybe that's the point of him, is to come in there and rattle things up. But then when he's gone, he does have a pretty effective death, though.
Yeah.
You know, one thing this movie does, and Tarantino's done this very well in his movies, a guy that's also lived off violence, people criticized him for it. this movie and his movies and other great ones too show the effect of it. It hurts. Yeah. It's dirty. It's ugly. It's cold. Apparently Gene Hackman regretted wearing just a tank top in that scene where he dies because it was cold where they're shooting the movie. Another movie that isn't really set in cold temperatures, but actually was cold when they were shooting it. Mm-hmm. And he had to do that scene over and over again, also with makeup and everything else on him too.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about Kill Bill after seeing this film, because Kill Bill takes it to the next level where there's a ridiculous amount of geysers of blood, but they're just elevating the level of violence so much that it's kind of the lens being turned back on the audience, being like, why do you like this so much? Something I always loved about Kill Bill, when the bride gets hurt, she's hurt.
Yeah.
She gets tired, even though she's like superhuman. There's a real peril there, and it kind of changes the tone of the film. And one of the best things about Bonnie and Clyde, and probably why people considered it so violent, is because you saw the pain. You saw it slow them down. My favorite scene probably in the film is after Buck gets that fatal shot and he's gruesomely slowly dying of a shot to the head. He's clearly not with it. He's been damaged and they're trying to figure out what to do. But then the cops come and they have to run. Both Clyde and Bonnie get shot, non-fatal, you know, in the shoulder and in the arm. But they hurt. They're in agony. Yeah. And they get away with CW. They get to the car. And then that bluegrass music starts up again.
Yeah, the banjo music. Yeah.
And it's the getaway music. But at that point, you're just so horrified by what's happened. And you realize the commentary that that makes about how we feel about violence. That's why people were so disgusted by the violence. Because the film found a way to affect them better than all these other gangster movies did, where somebody would just get shot and disappear, go off screen and die. Have the constipation death. You don't really see it, so it doesn't feel as visceral.
But in that moment, we've lost two members of the gang.
Yeah.
And his own brother. As much as everyone dislikes Blanche, they've lost those two members. And who knows if the two of them are going to survive.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty badly wounded. Mm-hmm. Clearly, they never recover from that. I don't think they rob a bank after that. They're just kind of hiding
The real out. Bonnie at the end was unable to walk. Maybe because of that situation. I didn't read thoroughly about that. But she was not able to get around the same way anymore. So maybe that's one reason why they didn't get out of the car. She couldn't walk around anyway. The real car, I'm saying, now. All right, Estelle Parsons, who played Blanche, no other AFI film. She was in Paul Newman's Rachel, Rachel. She was in Dick Tracy that Beatty made, and she was Roseanne's mother on television.
No kidding.
And we'd mentioned Shelley Winters way back on A Place in the Sun played her mother. So two Hollywood legends and Academy Award winners that Roseanne got. That was pretty smart casting on her part. The real Blanche was not the shrill fool played by Parsons, but the reason why they did it that way was to make Bonnie look cooler and sexier and more awesome, more together. But I did think, seeing this movie yet again, I've seen it so many times, 5 or 6 times now, that she was over the top and it was too much. And I didn't really like her performance the way I maybe did in the past.
She reminded me of Honey in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
I think Honey's better.
Okay, but you have somebody who has to play annoying. She's the only person that doesn't really commit any heinous crimes in this film.
Yeah.
She doesn't really do anything wrong.
But like we said before, before we started recording, we talked about this. When they go up to Gene Wilder and Evans's car, and they're all making silly faces and they're terrorizing them, she's part of that.
She's complicit. Don't get me wrong. She's totally complicit.
And she wants her cut when it comes to the money being divided up.
Yeah, they have to make it so that she's not a victim in this situation. I don't think they wanted the audience to develop any relationship with people who were victims of Bonnie and Clyde in any way. The real Blanche, I can't remember her actual name, but she sued the production because of her portrayal. Also, the real CW, or one of the people that CW was based on.
They were composites.
Yeah, they were composites, more than one person. But I guess the person who most closely resembled him got an out-of-court settlement because of the way he was portrayed. And I think he claimed that Bonnie and Clyde essentially kidnapped him and he had tried to escape several times. Who knows? Maybe that's just what he said to not get in trouble.
In the end, his dad's a turncoat and he kind of goes along
with it. But that's what he sued them for. The insinuation that he would turn on his friends, which doesn't really jive with his story of being kidnapped. But at any rate, the real people didn't really resemble the characters in the film.
That's typical for Hollywood. Pollard, Hackman, and Parsons are not Hollywood pretty at all. I love Hackman, but he's not a great looking guy. But at least that's one thing. They do come across as real people. Pollard, Hackman, and Parsons. Pollard was in Scrooge, Tango and Cash. 50 years in the business, he's still working. His father is Dub Taylor. Now, we mentioned that Beatty's in only one AFI film, but Taylor's in 3 in total. He was uncredited in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he's also going to be in The Wild Bunch. Denver Pyle, Uncle Jesse, is Frank Hamer.
Yeah.
And I tried to get you to figure out who he was, but you don't know much about The Dukes of Hazzard, so we did the whole, I'll let you think about it for a while, and you never did get who it was. He started working in 1947, so 20 years before this movie. Then he made his big name about 10 years after this with The Dukes of Hazzard. But he's got a pretty effective role as Frank Hamer, and he is a great antagonist for them.
And the family of the guy he was based on also sued the production. I think they also got a settlement.
Good thing this movie made a lot of money because they needed to make it all to pay off all these people that complained. I mentioned Gene Wilder a few times. No one really thinks about him when they think of Bonnie and Clyde, but he is in it. A fairly decent role. It's his very first movie ever. He's definitely better known for The Producers, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and Young Frankenstein. Of course, Blazing Saddles is another one. All those great comedies. It's a pretty effective role for me. He's kind of funny in it. What is his job? What is Eugene Grizzard's job?
He's an undertaker. That's right. Which disgusts Clyde.
Well, no, Bonnie.
Oh, is it Bonnie?
It's Bonnie. As soon as he says it, she's smiling. He says he's an undertaker. Get him out of here.
I'm not really sure why she has a problem with undertakers.
I think it reminds them of the fact that they might die.
Even though they've been responsible for the deaths of
probably still, don't remind us that we might die.
Half a dozen people at this point, yeah.
The director of the film, Arthur Penn, is only AFI-er. We talked about his credits already. He was influenced by Kurosawa's slow-mo style in the violent scenes. Seven Samurai has a lot of slow motion in the key moments, and of course at the end of this, that big shootout, very slow motion scene actually, we see it take place over the space of many seconds. His writers David Newman and Robert Benton, with some uncredited work by Robert Towne. Newman and Benton went on to write Superman, and then Benton had a whole great career after that. He became a director and, of course, still a writer. He did Kramer vs. Kramer,
yeah,
which was also a hit and an Academy Award winner.
I love that film.
And one of my favorites from the 90s in a low-budget, low-key kind of way, Nobody's Fool, with Paul Newman. Towne, I just mentioned being the script doctor, he also did some of that on The Godfather, and, of course, he got sole credit for writing Chinatown. The producer was Beatty working by himself, with his executive producer being Jack Warner. He must have clashed with him quite a bit. And he didn't repeat being a producer until Shampoo, 8 years later.
Oh, Shampoo was 8 years later.
But then he started becoming a producer pretty regularly on, if not all of his films, most of his films. Behind the scenes, the cinematographer Bernard Guffey, who shot the 1.85:1 movie, so we're not seeing the widescreen the same way. I don't think we see a ton of 2.35:1 in the next little while, because we talked about before, these movies are trying to be smaller, they're taking on tougher subject matter. The movie is Technicolor, though, so it is at least a color film. We saw a pretty solid DVD. It's a special edition I bought a long time ago, not the Blu-ray. Looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Bernard Guffey also did From Here to Eternity, so a black and white film, whole different kind of thing way back when, and All the King's Men, he did that one as well. And a theme we've had a few times with cinematographers and directors, Penn and Guffey battled, but Guffey won the Oscar. Russell Meddy on Spartacus did the same with Stanley Kubrick and won the Oscar. Haskell Wexler and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Mike Nichols, but Wexler won the Oscar.
Yeah.
Funny how that happens so often. The editor, Dee Dee Allen, we talked about her when we did Dog Day Afternoon's Not 100 Project a few weeks ago. She also was known for The Hustler, Reds with Beatty, and Breakfast Club, many other movies. I just want to find an interesting little sampling of different types of films. Good editor, but this is her only AFI film.
She had a long relationship with Penn. Mm-hmm. She worked with him as a collaborator a lot. She's considered one of the great auteur editors. I recognize her name. We've talked about her before. She was credited with pioneering the use of audio overlaps, which I actually question that because, I mean, we saw that in Citizen Kane.
And certainly in Lawrence of Arabia we saw a lot.
Yeah,
of
yeah,
and
exactly.
And V. Coates, another woman editor.
And another great editor with a great list of credits.
Mm-hmm.
Something she probably could take credit for is the jump cuts. Her use of jump cuts was considered a great innovation.
And what used that? The French New Wave, especially Godard.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Godard, definitely. She was known as the editor doctor. She's the post-production doctor that she would be called in to save films that were in trouble. She would forego continuity in favor of plot and character development. But if you look at her list, she has an incredible list of
credits. Thelma Schoonmaker works with Scorsese all the time. Yeah. I think I said the same thing. Yeah. Goodfellas has some jump cuts and some pretty bad edits. And she talks about in the commentary about, well, we want the better performance. Verna Fields is an editor for Jaws and some other films.
Mm-hmm.
Another female editor who's definitely in the top of their class. Look at all these women editors are mentioned.
I think I saw the statistic that at the time Bonnie and Clyde came out, they only made up 15% of editors on big budget projects. I think they said it was the top 250 films of the year. But they are considered a lot of the greatest editors.
Okay, a few more tech people. The composer Charles Strauss would have been involved in that banjo music, the bluegrass. He later wrote music for the musical Annie.
Oh, that was like my childhood favorite.
And John Huston directed that film. I always forget John Huston, of all people, directed that movie.
Yeah.
The set's Dean Tavularis, who's best known for sure with working with Coppola, The Godfather films, and Apocalypse Now. That right there is a resume for anybody. But he also was involved in this one. Not a lot of sets. I think a lot of this was location shooting. A lot of it was out in the middle of nowhere, obviously. Or process photography when they're in the cars.
Mm-hmm.
We've already mentioned so much of the influence. I'll go over a few more of them here. One thing we didn't talk about when we got to our tech credits a minute ago, the extra loud gunshot sound effects that were in Shane. And in both cases, the projectionist tried to fix something that wasn't supposed to be fixed.
Yeah.
And Bonnie and Clyde was doing it because of the same reason that Shane did. To make an impact when guns were shot. As I look at my long list of influence, I think I talked about them already. Natural Born Killers, Badlands, Thumb and Louise, fashion, violence.
Yeah, I think
this movie had a huge impact on Hollywood.
Those movies you're listening, they're almost homages. They're so directly influenced by Bonnie and Clyde, but you could also just say that in general, film was influenced, Hollywood was influenced. Every film from here on in was going to be a little bit more violent, a little bit more gutsy and daring, and a little bit more nihilistic and cool because of Bonnie and Clyde.
The awards and AFI lists, there's a lot here. The two Oscars, Estelle Parsons, the only one in this great cast that won an Oscar for supporting actress. And you mentioned Sandy Dennis. She won the year before, 1966.
Yeah, that's right.
Guffey Cinematography, despite his clashes with Penn. 8 more nominations. Best Picture, Best Director for Penn, Best Actor for Beatty, Best Actress for Dunaway. The two supporting actors, Hackman and Pollard. The script by Newman and Benton. And the costumes.
A.O. Scott has a great essay that he wrote about this film. And he was pointing out, even though Bonnie and Clyde was the best film of the year, and just about everybody would agree to that now, the fact that it didn't win is probably part of why it kept its cachet, because if it got credibility, then it could no longer be counterculture.
That's like, very
now
true.
Everyone's on to it now, so it's not cool.
I think that's very true a lot of times. When Scorsese hadn't won an Oscar for so long, there's a part of me that thought, he's in a group with people like Kubrick and Hitchcock and Chaplin and Buster Keaton and Wells and many others, all those foreign directors who never won a Best Director Oscar.
Yeah.
So it's almost like he should have been happy to be in that group.
Yeah. It means you're always ahead of Hollywood and everybody else.
I guess that applies to a lot of the people we just talked about in that list seconds ago. Yeah. All right. The National Film Registry for Bonnie and Clyde in 1992, 3 years in, but okay, there it is. It was 65th in the top 100 passions. That makes sense. Maybe could have been a little higher. Wee Rob Banks was 41st in the top 100 quotes. Parker and Barrow were 32nd on the heinous side of the heroes and villains list. And here we've talked about them, we've lionized them, and yet they were villains on that list. The movie was 13th in top 100 thrills, and it was 5th in the gangster category of the top 100 genres. So those last two obviously go hand in hand. The last three, I guess, actually. The villains, the thrills, and the gangster category. All right, this has been a rain-soaked, Saturday night noisy-type podcast. But we're at the end, so we both love Bonnie and Clyde. Absolutely one of my favorites. 27th the first time, it'd have been a little high, but definitely I was okay with it. Dropping to 42nd, I don't understand the drop. I'm glad it was at least as high as it was, though. And what about you? Where do you think it should have been, and what are your parting thoughts?
It's only the first time I've seen it, and I feel I'm a little bit jumping the gun saying this, but I think if I were to compile my own top 100, it might be in the top 10.
Really?
At least in the top 20.
And Sharon Candy would also be in there. Let's not forget that's another one.
Yeah.
I'm loving some of your choices. Films that most people wouldn't put there.
These are the types of films that make me love film. These are the reason why it's my favorite. They're gutsy, they're exhilarating, dense with meaning. And in the case of Bonnie and Clyde, it changed the art form itself. I've thought about this movie so much since I've seen it. I'm already looking forward to watching it again. Yeah, I think it would put it, like, near 10 in that neighborhood.
Hmm.
And when you named in the second list that is in the company of King Kong and, I think,
Midnight Cowboy.
I mean, those are good films that I respect. But no, Bonnie and Clyde is just, it's in a whole different world.
Hmm.
It's a masterpiece, an absolute masterpiece.
And it's held up so well. Some of the movies that we've liked haven't held up necessarily all that well.
That's true.
And, of course, a lot of movies we haven't liked have really come across as dated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so hooray for Bonnie and Clyde. Up next on the Top 100 Project is a bit of a left turn, and it's our only glimpse of Spencer Tracy and the last appearances by Catherine Hepburn and Sidney Poitier. And guess who's coming to dinner? Another movie you've not seen.
No, that's right, I've never seen it.
So the coming attractions trivia for guess who's coming to dinner. Like recent Top 100 Project flicks, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and now Bonnie and Clyde, GWCTD received Oscar nominations in all 4 acting categories. What are the other 4 AFI movies, after those 3, to receive nominations in the 4 acting categories?
Oh, that's really hard. I know one immediately.
Have to do your research on that like I had to. You have to know your Oscars to get that one, too.
That's a tough one. You know your Oscar trivia far better than I do. So for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. If you'd like more trivia, links to some of the things Brian and I talked about, and lots of other fun stuff from us, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of Bonnie and Clyde? We'd love to hear what you think of this film and anything else that we've covered on the project. Please send us a message. We'd love to hear from you. top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, we'd like to warmly thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee.
We end podcasts.
And cut.